I'm happy to welcome Anna Menzel and Aisha Fofana Ibrahim, who together with Nikki Spencer-Coker, Aminata Kamara, Alice James, and Mariatu Kaba are contributors to the recently published conversation called Making Sense of Girls' Empowerment in Sierra Leone. So thank you both so much for making the time to talk about your piece today. So first, Anna and Aisha, how did that piece come about? Anna, could you talk first on this one?
Sure, thank you. So I guess there's a short and a long answer to that question, and maybe I'll just give you both. So the short answer is that Aisha and I started to think about organizing such a conversation more concretely after we had seen Robbie Shilliam's tweet in which he announced the Testify series on Twitter. And I think our conversation is now the second article in this Testify series. So we saw this and we thought, well, this is where we can go with the kind of conversation that we want to organize and that we've actually been talking about for a while. And I really want to mention this, that sort of seeing the announcement on Twitter got us going, because having an academic outlet for collaborations with activists can actually make it easier to have them. For example, we got some funding for the transcription of our conversations from the research cluster where I work, because I was able to say, look, there's going to be an output in an academic journal. And, you know, that just made it easier to communicate that this was something that was, you know, worth funding and worth spending academic time on, so to say. So actually, I think we need more formats like this. So, and there's a longer answer, but I'll make it short. And that one is that Aisha and I have been thinking about how to make sense of girls' empowerment for a few years now. Aisha probably a lot longer than me and more intensely than me, because she encounters it all the time in Sierra Leone. So we first spoke about it, Aisha and I, when I was in Freetown doing research in 2016 and 2017. And we agreed that we did not really understand why so many women, you know, feminist activists, were so enthusiastic about girls' empowerment. Because the empowerment approach that is pushed by so many so-called development partners mainly focuses on changing girls' attitudes and behaviors without paying attention to the material realities they live in. And this is also what has been criticized so harshly in much of the academic literature on girls' empowerment. But then on the other hand, both of us know activists and even have friends who do girls' empowerment in Sierra Leone, either in donor-funded projects or in self-organized activities and initiatives, and some even do both. And we know that they are smart and that they have good intentions and that they are so dedicated. So we decided to just ask them, you know, what's up with this? What is it that you appreciate about this approach? And where do you see shortcomings? And that's what we did. And I have to say that Aisha did, of course, most of the organizing in Sierra Leone for this.
Great. Aisha, would you like to add something to that?
I think the conversations that we've been having for 5 years or more, I think they came into fruition when we saw that tweet. I mean, it made it realistic and it made it possible for us to do that. For a long time, I've been struggling with this concept of girls' empowerment. And so Anne and I, we met like twice in the last few years. And that conversation always came up. And we said, well, what is this empowerment? I mean, why is the burden on girls and on the structure? And why are we not addressing structural issues? Why are they addressing this? And I work in this field, and I know a lot of activists that are very passionate about this kind of work and using the language and the, you know, and this discourse. And I always argue with them. I say, well, have you thought about it? Have you thought about this? And have you thought about that? So when this opportunity came, it was just fantastic. So we really appreciate it.
What do you see as the key takeaways from the conversation and the piece? Aisha?
Sure. I think there are a few takeaways. And number one for me is even creating that space where activists and academics come together and talk about something that's very, very important in their context, especially in my context in Sierra Leone, where we want to ensure that young girls become empowered But how we do that is what I question. That's what Anne questions as well. And so these women that we talk to work with these and these girls on a daily basis. And for me, it's the idea that they will begin to understand where we are coming from, and that conversation led to that. We asked the question, and they said, "Well, yeah, we understand that." That it's and they also had those thoughts, but maybe they didn't know how to articulate them, because for them, it's important that we have something for young women that are challenged in our society. So where education has to be pushed, has to be made central in the lives of girls, where succeeding has to be. So you have to have that kind of support system to ensure that we don't have the high rates of dropouts that we have. And they want to ensure that young girls step up and take up after the generation that's doing this work. So I understand that from us. So we could see that in this. So they understand that it's problematic, but they also understand and overall they believe that it's important for this type of work to go on. So that to me is one of the key takeaways. Yeah, I'm sure Anne also has others that she wants to add.
Anna?
Yeah, one of my main takeaway points has to do with positionality, I think. So I realized something that I think I already felt before to some extent, but that I really understood when I listened to Nikki Aminata and Mariatu when they talked about, you know, girls' empowerment. And that is that it is really, in a way, easy to dismiss the value of the, let's say, self-esteem building that is part of these girls' empowerment approaches when, you know, you already take it as a given that, of course, as a woman, I can do it and I can achieve stuff and I'm worthy of being supported and promoted and what have you. So, like, I would say that in my upbringing and education, this was more or less a given. And, you know, it's really obvious that for many of the girls who enter these projects or initiatives, it is not. And there is value in this to some extent. But also, I think also in the conversation, you still see that this is in a way a producerist like kind of self-esteem, because it's always tied to girls being useful, to contributing to development in a certain sense and so on. But still, like, I think it's important to really acknowledge that building up self-esteem is something that is important. And you really see that in the conversation. And that was one of my main takeaway points. Then the other point that I have is that we see in some of the initiatives that we discuss in the conversation that they actually go beyond what is usually, I don't know, criticized in the literature on girls' empowerment, because they're not only about telling girls that they can do it and like approaching empowerment in a very individualistic sense. They're also about connecting women and girls so that they can help one another, that they can exchange experiences and so on. And this is something that you see in the kind of mentorship program that Mariatu envisions, that Aminata is already working on, I think also. And you see this in the conversation. So there is something that goes beyond that. It's not just about single girls trying to make it in a world in sort of a very like super capitalist kind of way, but there is something about community as well. And this was really new to me. And this is also pointed out actually in one of the articles that we read before during the conversation by Yemzi Akinbobola on neoliberal feminism in Nigeria, where she also points out that not everything is just individualistic. There's also like a community element in there that is often not recognized. So I thought that was interesting to see, and that was one of my main takeaway points.
Can I add to that?
Yes, absolutely.
It's interesting that Anna talks about the not being individualistic and being communal. I think that's just part of the society that we live in. And I think for me, that's what I respect about the people that do this work, because they don't lose that part of our culture, even though the discourse is about individualism. They try to ensure that we don't lose community out of it. And so that connection with the older generation and the connection within young people trying to survive within such a patriarchal society, and trying to survive within all of these things that are going on. And you see that what they're focusing on is building lasting relationships with one another. So that's part of our society. So that's, for me, it's not new. But for me, what I respect about that is that they're holding on to that aspect of it as well. So yeah, that's what another takeaway for me.
So this focus on girls and women's individual empowerment was also brought up several times in the piece, and several people commented on the problem of a lack of focus on tackling structural constraints. What do you and the other contributors see as the key constraints, and how do you think they could be tackled?
This is a really tough question, because the structural constraints are some of the things that people advocate for in terms of policy change. So as they advocate or try to build self-esteem among young women, as they advocate for laws against all forms of child abuse, and try to deal with the issues that prevent young girls from succeeding, I think that advocacy in terms of changing laws, creating safe spaces in schools, creating policies. For example, in schools, you have something around code of conduct for teachers. So as people like Maria to Nikki and Aminata, as well as Ms. James, as they work on these issues, they also look at this constraints and see the ways in which they can intervene to ensure that these are tackled in one way or the other. The ways that have been tackled so far have been like policies, advocating for laws, changing policies or development of new policies in schools or at the national level. So yeah, so that's what's happening.
Anna?
Yeah, I think that Nikki, Aminata, Maria, too, and Alice, they all agreed that, you know, there's not enough focus on structural change in Sierra Leone. There's a lot of focus on empowerment, and a lot of times we ask, but what does it mean to be empowered if you're still living in poverty? And I think this is really perhaps the issue. The structural constraints, they go far beyond anything that could, you know, only be achieved by girl empowerment. And they're also not only an issue for like women's or feminist activism. It is really about poverty and the big questions, you know, how can Sierra Leone get to a place where people do not, you know, actually have to worry about everyday survival, and where education is quality education and not just free education, which sometimes means that girls sit in a classroom and still they don't learn anything, and so on. So, but I think these are like huge questions. I think in the conversation you can also see how we struggled with them, and the one thing that everyone agreed on was that what is happening in terms of girl empowerment is not addressing these issues, and that the task ahead is finding a way to begin to have a conversation about these issues as well, and not just focus on self-esteem building, empowering girls and women in the sense of giving them self-esteem and telling them that they're worthy of being supported, even though that is important, but going beyond that. So I think that we, like the way that the conversation went, was that the activists recognize and voice that they want to go beyond this, but are still not sure how to. I think this is how I understood it. There's no like clear answer in our conversation, but the desire to move forward.
Aisha, did you want to respond to that?
I think Anna is right. They say the constraints in the sense that there are certain things they know have to exist for these changes to take place in the lives of young women. So, and what they try to do, like I said before, is to ensure that there are policies, and then they advocate for laws as well. So when teenage pregnancy became something that they had to advocate for policies and to revise the Child Rights Act, that was done. So they recognize that there are constraints. They recognize that these constraints, no matter how much empowerment that they provide these young girls, if these are not tackled, it will be of no use. And so alongside their advocacy, alongside the work that they do with the girls, they're also advocating for these changes, whether it's in laws or policies. And the free education that Anna was talking about, what can be done to ensure that girls are not just in class, but they're learning when they're in class. So these things go simultaneously. But because you're dealing with issues mainly around the state and also cultural biases, it's the constraints sometimes look and they seem insurmountable. But they're doing this work side by side with the work they're doing with the young girls, as well as the work they're doing with the state and with the community.
So something that else that came up in the piece were steps and procedures in place to access international donor funds. What do you and the others that were part of the conversation see as the role of international actors like UNICEF and the World Bank, but also governments such as those of the UK and the US in this movement going forward, if you see a role for them? Anna?
Yes, I thought that was extremely interesting. The parts of the conversation that focused on donors and their potential role. So the way I'm not so much going to talk about like what I think, but the way I understood the activists is that some of them are very skeptical of donor involvement as it is at the moment. For example, if you look at Nikki's contributions in the conversation, you will see that she points out that there are so many reporting duties and such tight timeframes to implement projects. And there's just so much control that donors try to have over what is being done by practitioners, activists, and that this is really harmful and inhibiting them and actually making it harder for them to be innovative and to build, not just projects, but build a lasting movement. But it's also pretty clear that most of our conversation partners, the activists in our conversation, that they still had quite a bit of hope that donors will be able to make a positive contribution. And that they also said that, of course, they need donors. This is the world they work in. And what I found really interesting was also that they have this idea of mobilizing donors against the Sierra Leone government, in the sense that they think that donors can put pressure, like have conditionality, like put pressure on the government to bring about reforms that they would not otherwise see. For example, legal reforms that would benefit women and girls. So they still have, in a way, even though they are annoyed by the control and the tight time frames and so on, a lot of them still seem to have hope that donors can be a force for good, so to say, and move things forward. And I thought it was really interesting and important to know that there's still quite some trust and hope there.
Aisha?
I think I agree with Anna. I think one of the things about the amount of time people spend on trying to meet the donor conditionalities tends to take away time from actually implementing the project in a way that is more conducive for the environment in which it is being produced. So I think one of the critiques that I had was about the unrealistic the unrealistic nature of some of the demands from donor partners. But like I said, in terms of reform, legislative reform, this is where the donor partners become very useful because they have some kind of leverage over the states, like Anna mentioned. So the practitioners and these advocates, what they do is look at that aspect and say, okay, we want to change this because this is a big constraint in the work that we do. And we can use our donor partners to push for this. And then, because the government listens to them most of the time, we're able to get this. So we know you're not perfect, but we can use you as well. I mean, we can work with you to ensure that we get. So for me, these are all strategies that people, the practitioners are using. And they know they have to strategize to get what they want from the state. They know they have to strategize to get what they want from donor partners so that the work that they want to see happen or want to see done in the communities with these young girls is achieved. And it's about ensuring that young girls are educated and it's ensuring that they have a place in society where they can stand on their own and be responsible citizens, even with the challenges that exist within the society. Because if women are not recognized at all as it is, and young girls have no hope of changing their future, that becomes that problem continues. So I think that's what practitioners are trying to do, is trying to reduce that. So building a group of young women that at least understand the situation and are trying to change that situation. So whilst they're doing that, they're also trying to ensure that the state is changing laws, while the practitioners are trying to build esteem and capacity of young girls. They're also trying to change laws, policies in schools, and community attitudes towards these girls. Because sometimes, like for example, the safe spaces that are created, they have to have community buy-ins, and they have to have community members that are supporting this. So they have to work with the community to ensure that they allow these girls to go somewhere where they can be, where they can talk about their issues and where they can be themselves and grow within those communities. So they have to work with communities, they have to work with the states to ensure that we have new laws and policies, the schools, the education system, as well as the donor partners who in many ways have influence over the state as well.
Anna, did you want to respond to that?
I myself, and I think maybe also Aisha, but I'll let her speak for herself. Like, I'm certainly usually more pessimistic about the role that donors can play in development, in actually bringing about development in the sense that people's well-being increases and that it's tangible and they actually have a better life. So I tend to be more pessimistic about this than the activists in our conversation. But also I was thinking this is, of course, again, a point that is, you know, important to know that they are still hopeful and that they have their strategies in working with donors. And this is also, again, regarding positionality, it's probably easy for me to be pessimistic because my life doesn't depend on it, right? My life doesn't depend on donors and my work, well, my work kind of does in academia, but still, but it's a different story. But yeah, so I think it's important to also see these relatively positive attitudes because sometimes it's easy to highlight critical voices, but it's also important to know that a lot of people still have hope and want to work with donors. As an insight, that is important, I think.
Absolutely. All right. Thank you both so much for talking to me today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you so much.